early in the morning, rise into the street. Light me up that cigarette, and I strap shoes on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason things went wrong. Got to find a reason why my money's all gone. I got a Dalmatian, I can still get high. I can play the guitar like on.
Hey everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you every day, talking about HR with people out there, living it, getting it done. So let's get to our guest as quickly as possible here. So welcome, Jolene Goronkin, to Drive Through HR.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, if you would, have you introduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll roll into our first gigantic question.
Okay, all right, and it's a big one. So my background has been operations, leadership development, human resources. About 5 years ago, I founded my own company, People and Performance Strategies, and we're really focused on two things. You know, the first being really making sure that people know how to communicate, understand people's styles and the differences. And we use the Everything DISC model, Marston's model from 1923, that says what style I am and what combination I am and how can I be more effective in my communication. And we do management, leadership, workplace, conflict resolution, and customer service and sales, and really individualized coaching. And that's one part. And then the other part is that I actually do a lot of project work in human resources, more on strategy for small to mid-sized companies. So I'm actually on retainer and really act as that acting HR person. So I've got a unique perspective in that I'm a service provider, but I've also seen, you know, what companies are really doing and what the needs are out there.
Nice. Jolene, let's do what's top of mind or what's keeping you up at night, but also let's do from your client's perspective, what's keeping,
okay,
what your perspective is on what's keeping them up at night.
Yeah, and, you know, I've got small to mid-sized clients, but we've also got some bigger clients that we help with their leadership development and things. But I think the big thing that I'm seeing right now and the gap, I mean, everybody's talking about the Affordable Care Act and the minimum wage and all these things, and how that's going to affect prices and competition going forward. But I see a unique way of looking at work-life balance when we look at the next generation of leaders in our, you know, in business. And I, you know, I've got stepkids that are in their, you know, late teens and early 20s, so I see it firsthand. But I think companies are really going to have to figure out how do I evolve and change my perspective when it comes to leadership development and getting ahead. Because I think it's got to look different in the future. It's got to be a much more balanced approach. And I think you had somebody on 3 weeks ago that talked about the whole giving back and volunteering and being part of your community. But I think it goes further than that. It truly is about being able to balance your life. And maybe the baby boomers and the Xers were much more focused on material things, where I think this generation is not as much about that. They want to make a difference and they want to have balance.
Where do we learn conflict resolution? Like, where, you know, we pop out of the womb at one point. Where do we learn how to communicate, how to resolve differences? Like, what's your whole kind of bent on that?
Well, I think you learn from your family first. So how does your mom and dad really identify conflict, and how do they handle it? Do they sit down and talk? Do they pretend it's not there? Do they scream and yell? I think there's definitely things that you learn in your family that you'll take to the workplace. But ultimately, what I really believe is that people really need to understand themselves first. Why do I do the things that I do? When you look at Marston's model and the DISC, you have D, I, S, and C. So four distinct personal styles, so to speak, and we're all a combination of all four. But if I'm a D, that means I'm dominant. I'm very, it's much more of a commanding personality. Or if I'm an I, I'm more of that cheerleader, yay, rah, rah, let's rally the troops and let's have some fun. And S, the steadiness style, really focuses more on support and being nurturing and being part of that team and being able to help people. And lastly, but certainly not least, is the C, or conscientious people that are very analytical and very logical, tend to be more private, tend to really hold things in unless they're forced to bring them out. So I think, you know, understanding yourself first and then figuring out, okay, how do I need to adapt my style to other people's styles?
In the workplace and all of your work, how have you seen how different generations are, or I say how, I don't want to assume that different generations have a different approach to conflict or conflict resolution. So why don't you take us into the world of kind of what you've seen in mm-hmm. the generations and how what their general approaches are to resolving conflict?
You know, I don't know that there has been any studies on the generations and how they deal with conflict. I really do believe it's that innate style. So whether you do DISC like we do at People and Performance Strategies, or whether you take the MBTI or Myers-Briggs or the StrengthsFinder or the colored hats, you really understanding your innate style is key. And we're all going to have one that we gravitate more than others.
And in terms of the generations, let's keep kind of going forward with that. But outside of conflict, what do you see as kind of the biggest obstacle or thing that kind of we're going to get blindsided by? You know, we have, I say, four generations at work right now, commingling, et cetera. What's coming around the bend with generations?
I think the big thing is flexibility in trying to figure out how do I manage my business, whether you're in retail or manufacturing or farming or, you know, restaurant, whatever it is, how do I manage my business with the perspective of flexibility? And, you know, somebody wants to go to a soccer game at 3:00, but you are supposed to work till 5:00. How do you manage that? You know, somebody wants to work out during lunch versus, you know, taking a typical lunch. What are the things that you can do as a president, CEO, or human resource department to make this a more flexible and adapting environment for the next generation?
You know, it touches on work-life balance, and I wonder what your take is, you know, just in general on how we should approach, like when you get a new client and you might ask the question, like, hey, what's your approach on work-life balance? What do you think companies should do to attract top talent in the future as it relates to a work-life balance?
Well, you need to be sincere and authentic. So if the workload is going to be 50 or 60 hours a week, don't tell them it's going to be 40 or, you know, 35. You know, be very upfront and honest about the culture of the company, because the culture of the company is going to drive that work-life balance. And I think if your values are centered around making sure that there is that balance, then you're going to do things that will be able to promote that. But ultimately, we're all in business to make money. So, you know, there can't be so much flexibility that people aren't doing what they need to do and productivity is not high. I do think giving some flexibility will actually increase your productivity in an organization, but also you've got to be able to have that trust, and trust in your employees, trust that they're doing what they need to do, trust that the work gets done, and that it's results driven. Are you there?
Yeah, Brian must be on mute. Let me ask you a quick question about loyalty. I've been thinking a lot lately about loyalty and kind of how the free agent nation years ago kind of came out, and we talked a whole lot about how people were going to jump around, and it's in, you know, it's almost in conflict. Like, I was in the marketing and advertising and PR world, which is very hierarchical. You come in as an intern, you're there for, you know, for a while, you do a coordinator, then manager, and then you move up and director and VP, and you're a partner. Like, it takes forever to, you know, basically 10 years in the marketing game, PR game, advertising game. But at that point, you've really achieved, et cetera, if you haven't gone client side, et cetera. But it's very hierarchical. And a lot of people would switch out and move jobs. And it kind of flies in the face of kind of the new workforce, you know, both Gen Y, I'd say, even and millennials, on how they approach wanting to work for a company for a long period of time. So if you don't mind, give us your take on just kind of loyalty and kind of our an approach that you see out there in the marketplace that works in terms of either building loyalty or creating a new brand of loyalty, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah, I think you have to understand what your employees want first. So have you asked them? That would be the first thing, either through a survey or through interviews, you know, an open door policy, some way to be able to communicate what's important to them. A study in the restaurant industry recently said that employees in, you know, hourly employees really want to be able to have a cool uniform or, you know, things that really they want to have breaks. Things that are important to them may not be important to you. So you've really got to understand what your employees want. And the only way you can do that is ask. And I think that's the big key. But then figuring out what can you do, given the resources of the organization, given the limitations to, you know, how much of an expense, That's got to be the first step, is really understanding what they want and can you afford it, and then communicating back to them, saying, hey, you know what, we did this survey. Here are the things, the top three things that we learned, and just recently did one that really the three themes were we want more team building and teamwork, we want more communications, and we want more recognition. So, okay, we've got three things, three themes that came out of this survey. Now what do we do? What are two or three things that we can do this year to really implement change and increase the overall engagement? Because it can't be just about satisfaction anymore. Loyalty is driven through engagement. It's about feeling connected to that company.
Hey, Jolene. I've got a theory, and I want to get your opinion on it. If the workplace truly allowed people to be themselves, open, honest, just communication's kind of the priority, I just don't feel there would be any of the generational kind of style gaps, all the issues that are supposedly created because of generations. I just think that would go away. Thoughts?
I think there's always got to be a filter. I mean, I think about my career and the things, the things that I did, the mistakes that I made. I really didn't have a filter when I first started in business. And, you know, I think you've got to learn to filter certain things, but you can still be yourself. You don't have to sell yourself to get your point across. I think that's the big thing that I would see. Yes, you have to be authentic. Yes, you want to be able to make sure your wants and your needs are known and that your opinion is out there. But conflict resolution is all about getting all of those things out on the table and then getting buy-in to one direction. It's got to be many minds, one voice. For conflict to be really effective and constructive, that's where you have to get to. You've got to be able to debate the topic and then move on in a much more constructive way.
Why does there have to be a filter? I mean, I think that actually, my theory is that's part of the problem, is that's an assumed, I mean, that's a gigantic assumption, and it just makes people be something they're not. You can't really be authentic and put these filters in place, and so why is that? Why do you feel that is?
Well, I think, you know, a filter is yelling versus talking calmly. a filter is saying it a little bit in a more delicate tone, because I am, my style is much more reserved, and I'm going to be taken back, and I'm going to clam up if I hear this yelling and screaming from you. So I think a filter in that, how you deliver what you're saying or what you're thinking, is important.
Yeah, and see, that's where, and again, I think that if people just did that and then the facilitated, like management or people help facilitate why the yelling was and get to the root cause, again, because that just gets pent up. If people are like wanting to yell about something that's not a malicious attack. I mean, sometimes if it's a malicious attack versus just I'm really passionate about it and I need to get this out of there, I just still feel get it done and then move on and manage it better, because the best cultures are highly charged. It's not a management. The ones that I've seen are highly charged, and then just blows up creativity and people are passionate, and they deal with the exception for the people that can't manage their, like, emotions. They deal with that on an individual basis and not a blanket kind of culture management.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. I think, you know, healthy debate and constructive discussion, all those things are absolutely important too, and passion behind what you're talking about. But I'm talking about when it goes that next step, when it gets disrespectful. And that's when you have to stop it, and you have to be able to filter that.
Who defines
let me do a quick reset, and then you do it. Drive through HR, everybody's listening to Jolene Garonkin. William, I think you have a question.
I do. I was just trying to get to the who defines what is and isn't disrespectful?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. I think you've got to define workplace policies and procedures in a handbook or a policy manual. You've got to be able to have that culture and understanding in the organization, what's acceptable, what's not, and people have to understand it. So draw me a picture of what great behavior is and what not so good behavior is, so that I know going in.
Well,
so I think the company defines it and leaders define it.
Well, the only struggle there is that policies and procedures are going to be able to define the known. What they can't do ever is define the unknown. And the unknown, you know, sometimes rears its ugly head where, you know, I might have thought that something, you know, wasn't disrespectful, let's just say. And then all of a sudden, a year later or 6 months later, then the person finally says, hey, you've really been offending me this whole time with your, you know, Native American jokes or Indian jokes. And by the way, I just so happen to be Native American, et cetera. Like, that isn't something the policies and procedure handbook can ever tell us. So how do we get to that? How do we get to the content of, I mean, the black and the white is really easy. I mean, you know, really, you have to be, like, socially awkward not to get black and white. It's the gray matter. The 55 shades of gray, if you will. That stuff, not easy. So how do you get to that with your clients?
Well, okay, so here's my advice on that. And I do this in sexual harassment training and workplace respectful workplace training with clients. Here's the three questions that I would say that you should ask yourself. And if the answer is yes, I think you need to rethink. So would I be embarrassed if my mother or my grandmother were listening to me or seeing me do this or say this? That's the first question. The second question would be, if a picture of me doing this or saying this is plastered on the front page of your local paper, would I be embarrassed? And the third thing is, if a loved one of mine, whether it be a daughter or a sister or a brother or a best friend, if this happened to them, would I be upset? And I think if the answer is yes to any of those, you probably shouldn't do it at work. It doesn't matter if it's legal or not legal, whether that would be how I would define respect.
Nice. They're all assumptive in terms of conscious, though? All three of those, which are great probative questions, but they all rely on the person being reflective and or if not being reflective, at least having a conscious. And I don't, conscious, most people think of it and conceive of it as, again, black and white. It's not. It in and of itself is gray. So now you've asked someone to basically, based on something that's gray, would you do this? And most people probably out in the light of day would say no, but then their actions would probably, well, it's still going on, so it leads you to believe that it still happens because either they don't have a conscience, which I don't really believe, or they're wrestling with the grayness of their conscience and
they're choosing to ignore it. And I think more than likely is what happens a lot of times. And I think that's when the company has to make a stand. Are you going to put up with it or not? And anything to it and not saying anything and just letting it go on, you're actually endorsing them. And you're endorsing that behavior. So that goes to the culture of the organization too.
Yeah, I had a guy one time. It's funny, in grad school, I was at the University of Arizona, and I was making a joke about him. He was in the class, we were talking, and I said, well, you know how these Laguna guys are, they're all drunk half the time, this, that, and the other. And everyone laughed, and we all kind of made fun of it, whatever. And then after class, he came and talked to me. He's like, hey, man, when we're together, you can say whatever you want. Like, I don't care. He goes, but I was in a classroom with a bunch of people that they don't know me, and they don't know a bunch of Laguna guys, and now they think we're all drunks.
Yeah.
And it really stuck with me. It's like, oh my God, you know, I was just making fun.
I was just making fun
of the situation. So it's really the unintended consequences of sometimes of the things we say or do that I think it's hard for people to wrestle with. Let me ask you a question
can I make one more comment on that?
You know, it goes
to the style of that person too. You know, and I keep coming back to DISC, but it's so powerful in that, you know, some people are much more private than others. And some people are much more conscientious and, you know, more thoughtful before they're gonna answer or they're gonna provide feedback or insight. So, you know, understanding that about people and understanding, you know, what you say. I mean, I'm out there. I'm a very big extrovert, and you know, I'm not real private. I can, you know, I can get through a lot of things and what people say. But ultimately, you know, that's part of my style. So I think that is, again, it goes back to considering what your natural style is and what the style of that other person is.
Oh, that's really good. All right, so I have this recurring dream. In some ways it's a nightmare, but it's a recurring dream that in 50 years, women will be in power, total control, total power. Everything that you had thought of the men in the last 400 years will be completely unraveled, and women will be just as guilty of all the heinous stuff that men have done. Women will do the exact same thing, like all the mistakes that men have made. And we could fill up libraries with the mistakes that men have made while in power. Of course, the adage of power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely. Yeah, men have lived by that for, you know, at least a couple centuries. I this dream has this 50 years in the future. Women make the exact same mistakes. So all of that stuff, it's just role reversal. Women basically make all the same mistakes. First of all, that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
But beyond that, do you think that women on any level will learn from the mistakes of men and do it better? Because I don't think anybody could argue that women aren't going to be in power. And I don't mean just a power as its relative. I mean power as in absolutely. Do you think that women will make better decisions than men have made?
You know, I think they'll make them for maybe different reasons. It's very hard to generalize, in my opinion. You know, we've worked years and years and years to have equal rights for all people and in the United States, and I think that's got to be the goal. It's not necessarily one, you know, gender or one ethnicity being in power. It's about collaborating and learning from each other. And I think being open to understanding, you know, the mistakes of the past so that they're not they're not made again is really, really important. And I would hope that, you know, women, men, everyone would be able to learn from the past. And even in interviewing, when you think about bringing it back to HR, you know, interviewing, you should be doing behavioral interviewing, which means I'm going to talk to you about past experiences because that's the best predictor of future behavior. So you really comes back to what's been done before and how have you learned from it.
Yeah, I like that, and I would love to think more like that. My problem is most people that I run into are not students of history. Because again,
yeah.
You know, you're right. I mean, I know you're right, but our problem is 80% of the populace that we interact with, they're not students of history. So if
yeah.
we're not students of history on all those levels, then we are doomed to repeat a lot
yeah.
of those things. So that's where the dream stems from, is that because we're not students of history, we're probably failed. And in this particular dream, it's women are failed to make a lot of the same mistakes. Hopefully they'll make better ones. Hopefully it will be
yeah,
kind of like new mistakes.
yeah,
hey,
less impactful.
I'll take that. Let me ask you a consulting question, because
okay.
I'm always curious to interact with consultants.
Mm-hmm.
Your favorite, kind of like what you love about being on the outside looking in and consulting and, you know, not dealing with any client-specific stuff, but what are the
mm-hmm.
what do you not like about consulting?
What do I not like?
On both sides. What do you love about it? What do you
oh,
hate
okay.
about it?
You know, I think that what I love is being able to see a lot of different industries. I work mainly with CEOs and top executives on strategy and really understanding how to increase performance through their people. And I think that's what I love. I love making a difference and focusing on the end result, because in my practice, I don't take jobs just to do, you know, just to do a manual. It's really about increasing performance in the organization. So how do you do that? So that's what I love the most, is making a difference every day. The thing I like least is probably, you know, leaving. is you know, consultants, they're not around all the time. They're not part of the organization, so to speak. So you are an outsider, and I think that sometimes it's probably the hardest thing is having to say, you know what, it's time for me to leave and you've got this and, you know, you're doing great things and let me know if I can help with the next stage.
Are there any, last question, by the way, are there any books that you've read lately that you would be willing to share that you actually enjoyed or were inspired by or something to that effect?
Yeah, you know what? I think The Work of Leaders, it's actually an Inscape book, and The Work of Leaders goes through crafting a vision, creating alignment around that vision, and then executing. It's written around the assessment, the Work of Leaders assessment, and I think that is one of the big things that people can say, whether you're in just starting in management, you're in middle management, you're an executive, how do I get to that next level? Well, it's about having that vision, whether it be a project vision or organizational vision, then how do I align my resources, my people around that, and then how do I end up executing, getting the results I need? So that would be my recommendation.
Well, that is perfect. Jolene, where can people connect up with you, our listeners, and after that, we'll roll. We're done. Quick 30 minutes.
All right. Well, PP Strat is my Twitter handle. You can www.ppstrat, People and Performance Strategies, so it's ppstrat.com. And we've got a great Facebook page that we really focus on leadership development posts and really understanding conflict and how to make things happen individually and as an organization. So like us on Facebook. Email me at jolene@ppstrat.com.
Perfect. Jolene, thanks for coming on with us. Folks, we're out of here. We'll talk to you tomorrow.